whichever way you slice it, would have seen large numbers of young girls in Epstein's orbit. Epstein took the coward's way out, took his life. Ghislaine Maxwell sits in a prison for her crimes.
If you believe he took his own life.
Here was a man that was buying young girls for the purpose of what? It's a problem across all sections of society. You know, we started with Jeffrey Epstein and the hoi polloi, and now we're in Rochdale. None of us have got clean hands. If you get on that plane, you'll end up probably being trafficked for sex. And she just became distraught. You're paying us for her, otherwise we won't let her leave.
Oh, shut up. No way.
$5,000. The way that they controlled me was they'd take out their mobile phone and go, is that your mother? Look at the date. You say anything, you step out of line, they get it.
Do we have any indication that there are other Epsteins out there?
Welcome to another episode of Heretics. I am absolutely shattered. I've been at this Dissident Dialogues event all weekend. Just saw Dawkins and Ayaan Hirsi Ali having a debate, which was quite extraordinary. Felt like a momentous occasion. Of course, she was the a woman who had a fatwa like Salman Rushdie had, who went into hiding and became an ex-Muslim and has recently shocked much of the, well, this kind of world, this world that in which we inhabit. When she announced that she was becoming or had become a Christian. So we had this amazing debate between Dawkins the atheist and Ayaan Hirsi Ali the Christian. So that was just wonderful, and hopefully they'll put the video up at some point. But that's not what this episode's about, is it? Today's episode is Andrew Wallace, who is a human slavery expert. He works for Unseen, where they try to do all they can to help to prevent people from being traded in that crazy, horrible slave trade. It's incredible what's actually going on, and some of the stories he has are just mind-blowing. It starts with a sort of Andrew and Epstein peg or hook for the first 5-10 minutes, just to, you know, that's the topical part of this. But then we move on to everything from organ trade to a forced surrogacy. It's just an extraordinary interview, I think. Not because I'm extraordinary, but he was just wonderful as an interviewee. So please do follow Unseen, go and help Unseen. That's his organization. It's weareunseen.org. And please share this episode far and wide, because I think it's an important topic. I will be back at the end, but here is Andrew Wallace.
Is it possible that Prince Andrew didn't know about Epstein?
Highly unlikely. Look, you've got Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Both were convicted for sex trafficking of young girls. And then you have around Epstein a large number of people, which, whichever way you slice it, would have seen large numbers of young girls in Epstein's orbit. And even if they didn't make the mental connection of this is sex trafficking, anyone would have said, what's going on here? So, no, I don't think it is possible. But we'll never know, because it's never going to go to court.
Do you not think?
Who knows? I mean, the wheels of justice turn slowly, don't they? But we'll see, you know. But the moment you start talking about Prince Andrew, everyone then goes to, oh, it's Andrew Epstein, it's the elites and all of that. We're going to talk about modern slavery, which is something that touches my life, touches your life, touches every viewer's life. And the danger of just focusing on that the whole time is everyone thinks, oh, it's something that's over there and it doesn't personally touch me. But, I don't know how the wheels of justice work. We observe, we keep watching. But what's not in doubt is Jeffrey Epstein guilty of sex trafficking, Ghislaine Maxwell guilty of sex trafficking. Epstein took the coward's way out, took his life. Ghislaine Maxwell sits in a prison for her crimes.
If you believe he took his own life.
Well, there we go. Conspiracy theory or not. But
I hate conspiracy theories. Yeah. I don't hate them. I know some have to be right. I mean, Epstein in itself was one that was right. There was conspiracies for a while theories about Epstein for some time before it came to light. There are some that obviously, Watergate was a conspiracy that was true. Rarely, but they are. And I think, like, the cameras were off, right? I think that's just known. The cameras in his prison were off.
Yeah.
It just seems unlikely that he could have taken his own life so quickly when they were watching him.
We'll never know. I mean, and that's the beauty of a conspiracy theory. I think he took the coward's way out. He didn't want to face reality, which is, you know, here was a man that was buying young girls for the purpose of what? If you have sex with somebody against their will, that's called rape.
Yeah.
So he was multiple times raping young girls.
How we're going to get into the dynamics of how this works on a global scale. Yep. In Epstein's case, how did it? What's the business of this? Where is there a website on the dark web? Where is he going about finding these women?
So what we learned with Ghislaine Maxwell was she, in effect, was the recruiter. So she was going out and recruiting, and what she was doing was looking for vulnerable girls, enticing them in, often around money. So she would, you know, look for girls that were poor, that didn't have, if you like, the sort of the social construct around them to keep them safe. They then were abused, and they were then forced to recruit others in that whole process. That model is not just true around sexual exploitation. It's true around forced labor, domestic servitude, forced criminality, that the exploiter looks for somebody that's vulnerable and preys on that vulnerability, is really clever and smart about how they prey on that vulnerable. They create a psychological connection, keep them under psychological control, but they're doing it for the sole purposes of exploiting that individual and inevitably for the sole purposes of making money. Now, the Epstein thing is slightly different, a fabulously wealthy individual, and he was using Ghislaine Maxwell to recruit girls for his personal gratification.
So I've got an image in my head of sort of an almost Oliver Twist character of Ghislaine walking around the streets and finding people who are down on their luck and saying, hey, here's a bit of cash. Is that accurate in any way, or is it a mix of things?
It's a mix of things. So that, you know, there were an orbit of young girls that she had access to. She would have been very adept at spotting who's the person that I can prey on. And I deliberately use that word because it is prey, you know, almost like a psychopathic way. You know, they're spotting, that's the person that I can draw in, get under my control, and then I can exploit them. And then I create the environment by which they don't feel free to leave. And look at the time span as well, which is even some of the victims have taken decades to come forward because dealing with the reality of what's happened to them and getting free from that control is huge. And the psychological trauma, you know, that they've got to go through and work through before they can say, actually, this happened to me. And you know, just take a step back. You know, imagine if that was you. And I've talked with clinical psychologists, and they say, at a minimum, between when exploitation takes place and when that individual can talk about it and not re-traumatize themselves is at least 7 years.
Wow. You're basically taking a huge chunk of someone's life away from them when you do this.
Yeah. And look, what modern slavery, here's a definition. It's not a legal definition. It's not, you know, something that governments have signed up to, but I think it helps people understand what it is. Modern slavery is an illicit commodity trade. The commodity is a human being. So what happens is a human being is turned into a commodity. And just think of the psychological trauma of that, realizing that you're nothing more than something that has been bought, that's been sold, and has now been exploited, and you can't see a way out. You're fearful to leave. There may be threats against you, against your family. You lose all hope. That's what it is. It's the dehumanizing of an individual into nothing more than a commodity in order to make money for your exploiters.
Do we have any indication that there are other Epsteins out there? Are you on the lookout? I know most of your work is with ordinary people doing this, but big celebrities, big money people?
I don't. But what I would say is just as with victims, the same is true with exploiters. They come from every walk of society, every country in the world has got a problem with this. I've met victims who didn't know what a mobile phone was, and I've met victims that have got an MBA and all points in between. And the, if you say, what's the common denominator? It's that vulnerability quotient. It's either somebody recognized them as vulnerable and preyed on them. So we have like what's called the lover boy syndrome. So this is around sexual exploitation. You know, girl, say in a village in Eastern Europe, guy swoops in, adores her, showers her with gifts. You're my girlfriend. All of this. This go on for a year, 2 years sometimes. Then, oh, let's keep it to the UK. Let's go on holiday to London. Travel to London, arrive in London, come through passport control or on the Eurostar or whatever. Give me your passport because I'll just keep it safe. You know what the streets of London are like. It's dangerous in that whole process. Why wouldn't you trust, you know, the boyfriend that's been with you for 2 years, you know, adores you and all of that. Let's go and visit this place, or we're staying at this place. Walk into the flat. And I'll make it gruesome because sometimes it is gruesome, and literally sold to the person in the flat in front of them. And then multiple rapes take place in order to, quote, break that individual, and then sold into the sex trade.
Oh, my God.
That's the reality. And you say, well, why does that person take 2 years? Because of the payoff, because of the money that they can get for that individual.
How much money can they get?
Well, you know, I've seen figures like 250,000.
What you described, it's, you know, I used to do a lot of videos, particularly on cults.
Yep.
And the cult dynamics of love bombing somebody, cutting off the rest of their family. It sounds really, really similar. Obviously, cults are often run by people with narcissistic disorders. Do you have an idea of the profile of the kind of person who is, what are they? Slave traders?
Exploiters, traffickers, enslavers. All doing the same thing. What's the profile? You are prepared to see another human being as a commodity, i.e. not a human being. And you look at that individual and you say, okay, they can make me money. Hmm. And whether it's in sexual exploitation or it's in forced labor or it's domestic servitude or it's forced criminality or all of them, you know, I've met victims that were in forced labor situations during the day and then forced sexual exploitation during the night. Why wouldn't you? Because you want to maximize the profit and the return on your commodity and on your investment. All the way through to organ trafficking. Again, why wouldn't you? You know, if they've run out of, if you like, use, then let's go the whole hog.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about organ trafficking in a bit because that's just so gruesome. I can't imagine that this poor person, the moment they realize that everything from the last 2 years has been a lie and they're about to go through the most brutal possible thing. Is part of your job at Unseen meeting these victims? And are they most, I'm imagining mostly young women, but is that how it is?
Well, no, it's about 50% women, 50% men.
Oh, wow.
What we do, so we're part of what's called the UK's national referral mechanism. So when people are identified as potential victims of trafficking, they, under what's called ECAT, the European Convention Against Trafficking, are entitled to support whilst the state makes a decision around, is that person a victim of crime?
Okay.
And so that can be accommodation, that can be help with establishing their identity because they've lost their papers, or rather their papers have been taken off them. It's psychological support, trauma support, health support, dentist. You know, sometimes horrific cases of people having their teeth smashed out with a hammer as a means of control. People arriving with, you know, if you look at them, you think, oh, hang on, that arm's not quite right. You know, they would have had broken bones, never gone to hospital, not sat properly in that whole process, all the way through to all of the psychological terrors and trauma around that. So our services are really trauma-informed, really highly skilled staff that work with them. And then also have to work with, if they're a foreign national, work with the Home Office, work with police, work with legal, For some of them, they will simultaneously have an asylum claim as well, because it's not safe for them to go back to their country. So it's like they're really complex problems to deal with. So we work with that. We then also run the UK's Modern Slavery Helpline. We just published our annual assessment the other day. A 20%, 20+% increase in call volumes year on year, nearly 12,000 calls.
So, something you were saying before, which I think people don't entirely realize. I mean, a third of my audience are in the States, a third are in the UK here, and a third elsewhere. How close we all are to this, not just people being sex trafficked, but just sex traffickers just around us. Is that right, that most people just watching wherever they are don't realize quite how close this is to home?
So I'll go big numbers and bring it all down to home. So the global estimate now is that there are about 50 million people in situations of slavery around the globe.
That's insane.
In the UK, we estimate at any one time somewhere between 120 and 130,000 people are held in situations of modern slavery. Last year, the UK, through the National Referral Mechanism, identified 17,000 victims. But that doesn't, it's not then 130 minus 17,000 and in 10 years time we'll be done. You know, I can pack up shop. That 17,000 will have been replaced. Why? Because it's such a profitable trade. So globally, the profits from slavery are about $500 billion per annum.
Wow.
And in the UK, it costs UK PLC about £50 billion. That's the cost of slavery.
What's PLC?
It's like the economic drag on the UK. So for the Home Office said for every victim, so there's a government figure, for every victim we find back in 2013, so if I factor in inflation, it costs the UK about £400,000. So that's policing time, health costs, support costs, costs of criminality, money not coming into the exchequer, etc. So for every victim, it's about £400,000. So 400,000 times 130,000, circa £50 billion. So it's a lot. Yeah, that just tells you the scale of it. In terms of that proximity, every country of the world has a problem with it. In the UK, we have found victims in the big cities, in the market towns, in the villages, in the countryside, the length and breadth of this country. So it's not something that we can think of, oh, it's a problem over there. It's a problem that's here. And it's a problem that affects UK nationals, it affects foreign nationals. And what drives it? That's what interests me. It's like, because I went to school, and we all learned when we went to school, certainly in the UK, is, you know, the UK ended slavery, William Wilberforce, rah, rah, rah. The Danes got there earlier, but, you know, edit that bit out.
Yeah.
But here we are, 2024, 50 million slaves, $500 billion industry. How did that happen? It happens because slavery is predicated on a demand for cheap goods, cheap services, and cheap labor.
And how do we counteract that?
Well, that's the thing that society's got to wrestle with. So when you go to the clothing shop and you think, right, I need 20 t-shirts for the summer. Well, A, why do you need 20 t-shirts for the summer? You don't. But you think I can have 20 t-shirts for the summer because the t-shirt's £2, £3, £4. So, you know, we can do that. But we never stop and ask ourselves, how is it possible that t-shirt can only cost £4. And I'm an ex-retailer. So, you know, when retailers say, oh, you know, it's the consumer that demanded it. Or, you know, when the supermarkets have their price wars, it's the consumer that demands it. I go, oh, hang on a moment. Who educated whom in the first place around this issue of cheap? Actually, it was the retailers. And what's shifted in the last 40 years hugely is this move away from value to one of just price.
Like Primark, Uniqlo.
Across the board.
But
So people say, oh, it must just be, you know, the fast fashion industry that's got, you know, if we're talking about apparel, it must just be the fast fashion industry that's got a problem with it. Literally a case this year of, you know, high fashion, in Italy, being made in Italy by Chinese forced labor, Armani.
Right.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in four of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, two carry on sizes, two checked sizes, four colours, black, blue, pink. Grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded. Both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favourite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
You know what I think, though, just from a nihilistic human perspective, and I always come up with a nihilistic perspective, I feel like if we were a little bit better educated about that, maybe there'd be a slump in sales for about a month, and then we would just continue doing it because we just disassociate the reality.
Well, it's that thing of, if I was to put in front of you cabbage number one and cabbage number two, and said, this cabbage, 50p, but I can't tell you how, you know, it was picked, how it got to market, how the workers were treated, etc. This cabbage over here, 60p. But the workers were treated great, paid properly, there's no exploitation. Which one are you going to choose? And you'll go, 60p.
Yeah.
Everybody listening will go, 60p. Within 2 weeks, if we were to observe your shopping, you'd be back buying the 50p one.
At least most people.
Most people. All right. Yeah. Most people.
And also, this is part of something I talk about quite a fair bit on the show, like luxury beliefs.
Yeah.
Because you get to a point where some people are in a good enough position financially where they can, obviously 50 and 60p is not a big difference, but £5 and £10 or something, where they can say, oh, I'm above all that thing. I'm a vegetarian by choice, but I know that I'm in a luxury position because often good vegetables and things are quite expensive. I know meat is as well.
Yeah.
But you have to pay quite a lot to get that kind of thing. So it's a bit of a luxury belief.
So 2 points. First point to the retailers is, why are you even putting the 50p cabbage on the market? Put the efforts into that 60p cabbage. You can probably bring the price point down a bit. So you can close the price point. I mean, you know, I'm just taking figures so we know around that. Because why should the consumer have to do all the hard work around, did a slave make that t-shirt? Did a slave make the solar panels on my roof? Did the slaves dig the raw minerals, a child slave, let's put it what it is, out of the ground in Congo that now powers my nice electric car? You know, who made my clothes? Let me ask you like three questions and just so it brings slavery right up close and personal. And I know it's like uncomfortable, but this is the world that we live in.
Well, people are going to want to turn off because they're feeling guilty. Don't turn off. You have to face this. Face the music.
I'm going to ask you three questions, which is, do you eat food?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you use consumer electronics?
No. Yes.
Yes. And are you wearing clothes? Yes, thankfully.
Today, yes.
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 Some days not.
Yes.
Without doing anything, you are personally connected to 40 to 60 slaves. That are in the world's supply chains.
That can't be.
And I haven't talked about car washes, nail bars, restaurants, takeaways, construction sites, logistics, distribution, factories. And, you know, and we haven't got into domestic servitude or sex trafficking without trying. So we're just talking around forced labor. That's the connection that you have. That's the reality in the world's supply chains.
What do we do?
Well, if you're a consumer, you start asking questions. So look, I'm ex-retail. Go into a store, be nice. All right. Don't go and harangue, but go in and say, can I speak to the manager?
Yeah.
And you know, eventually the manager will come and just say, look, I really love your products. I want to spend my hard earned pounds, dollars, euros, wherever you are in the world. But can you assure me that your products are not tainted by forced labor?
And they'll say, no, but you go to this one where it, you know, and this is going to cost twice as much though.
Well, I would be shocked if they even said that. They'll say, I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
And then what you say is, I'm going to come back in a week. Can you contact your head office and ask? And I know the way that retail works, which is if enough things percolate their way up to head office, they go, oh, hang on, the consumer's onto something. We're going to have to do something about it.
Sure.
And maybe we haven't done enough in response to legislation. We can come back to that later. The second thing is recognize that how we consume impacts people's lives. And we already know this, but now I'm adding another complexity into that whole problem. The third is we all have pensions, or lots of us have pensions.
I should do.
Yeah. Are you ethically screening your pensions? We all have bank accounts. Are you asking banks where they invest your money in that whole process? Yeah, are we curious enough about the world that we live in? And look, here's the awkward thing. As people watch this, hopefully they haven't turned off because the questions are awkward, and you're wrestling with 40 to 60. It's kind of like it's the inconvenient truth.
Yeah.
But then the question becomes, well, now that you know about this, what are you actually going to do? And look, I have the privilege of leading an organization that works with people that have found themselves in situations of slavery, where it's forced labor, sexual exploitation, or whatever. Mm-hmm. They are somebody's brother, sister, father, mother, uncle, aunt, niece, nephew. And back to, I've seen somebody with an MBA and somebody didn't know what a mobile phone was, UK nationals, non-UK nationals. It could be your brother, your sister, your uncle, your aunt, your niece, your nephew, your mother, your father. It could be you. And the reason I say it could be you is there's only three things that keep us safe from exploitation. One is we have a roof over our head. Two, we have community. And three, we have work.
I really am very nihilistic with this. And I do feel like people wouldn't admit it to themselves, but they would rather just not think about it. And I think there are loads of other cases where we do that, sometimes around climate change, sometimes around food, how animals, I'm not saying people should be a vegetarian just because I am, but there's no doubt that the way animals are kept is horrible. And when I used to eat meat, I just told myself, don't think about it. And I think you're absolutely right. You have to point to the individual stories for people to fully be able to empathize. How did you get into this line of work? Because it was quite an extraordinary story.
So initially, I used to work, I've worked in lots of different areas. I worked for a church and a colleague of mine went to the Ukraine, topical. Mm. But this was 2006, 2007.
Sure.
And he came back with this story, and I'd been to the Ukraine then, and you know, the rule was never put luggage in the hold because it never came out the other end unless you were prepared to give cash for your luggage to get back. So, but this was kind of like a story from the Wild West. And actually, it was over in the Eastern region where they were, in Donetsk, you know, which is where all the fighting's taking place. And he came back and told me this story. He said, well, we'd finished up. We were just in the hotel. We were in the bar, just having a drink, relaxing before we start the long journey back. And this girl walks in and walks over and says, are you the people that I'm meant to meet? And I go, no. Why? And thankfully, someone asked why. I said, I'm responding to this ad. And it was, you know, in the Ukrainian newspaper for this job selling ice cream in Central Park in New York for the summer, $80,000. And your face says everything. It's like, that's obviously not, you know.
So she was going to be, according to the ad, paid $80,000.
Yeah, to sell ice cream. Year?
Just here's the matter. Now you'll be selling ice cream.
Okay, come to New York, sell this. Fortunately, one of the people on the team was from the US and had been on one of the, every state in the US has a human trafficking task force. And so he knew about human trafficking, and he just went, listen, there's no job that's going to pay you $80,000 to sell ice cream in Central Park in New York. This is a classic setup. You will be trafficked. If you get on that plane, you will end up probably being trafficked for sex. And she just became distraught because she said, I've just saved all my money to buy the air ticket, and I was told to come here to meet the people that we're doing.
Was she crying?
I can't remember from... I mean, she was just... The story was she was distraught. It's kind of like you've put all your life savings in, you think you've got this job, it's like your world's falling apart. And again, put it into the context of Ukraine back then. You know, in the late 90s, early noughties, it was estimated something like 400,000 women, girls... predominantly disappeared from Ukraine into trafficking.
Yikes.
Around the globe. They clubbed together the money that they had, so that they gave her the money to pay back the airplane ticket and enough money to go home. And they said, whatever you do, do not respond to these ads. It's a setup in that whole process. And as that was going on, the people that she was meant to meet walked in, the traffickers. And they, fortunately, there were more of them than the traffickers. They then said, she's leaving. You're staying, she's leaving. And they said, no, you're paying us for her, otherwise we won't let her leave. They had enough money so that they could do that. But they said, we're not going to pay you until she's left. She left, and they kept them there, thankfully long enough so that they knew that she had a chance to completely leave and get out of town, and paid them off. Traffickers left, and then they thought, well, that's pretty wild. Now what do we do? Within 30 minutes, the traffickers had come back with the police who were in on the trafficking ring.
Oh, my God.
And they just said, no, no more money, we're leaving, et cetera, you know, forget it, and left. So that was the story that came back. And I went, okay, that's a pretty wild story. And what do I do with that kind of thing? Because back then, like, trafficking, what is that, you know? We had also, for a number of years, worked on the social orphan problem in Ukraine as well. And so what happened in and still happens in the Ukraine is social orphans are in orphanages until 16, and then they get turfed out at 16. And the team came back, and one of the team came to me, again, distraught, and said, look, we're just sending these, we work with these kids year in, year out, and then at 16, their world falls apart. And so I started asking questions like, well, what happens to these kids at 16? And they, like, the authorities didn't want to say and all that. And she pushed and she pushed and she pushed. And eventually they said, well, at best it's prostitution. Lots of them become drug addicts, but lots on turf out day, the Mercedes are lined up outside and they're the traffickers. And they come out and they get enticed into the back of the Mercedes and they're driven off and they're never seen again.
So these are wealthy people. I know I asked you before.
No, not
the traffickers.
The traffickers are wealthy, yeah.
Because I asked you before about the profile, I think the psychological profile.
Yeah.
What about the profile? I mean, who are these people? Are they, I mean, when they're in, obviously it's different in Ukraine to the UK, but are these the mafia? Are these?
Some is organized criminality. Uh-huh. So, you know, the National Crime Agency in this country or the FBI in the US or the equivalents around the globe would say, yeah, serious organized criminality is involved in this. Others are mom and pop operations. There was a case in Rochdale up in near Manchester.
Yeah.
Literally, there was a granny in Romania that was recruiting girls, sending over to her son and nephew who were running the illegal brothels.
The evil is just inconceivable.
Yeah.
It's just outrageous. This is, again, I watch movies like this. There was the new Wonka, for example, has a storyline a little bit like that. And I'm just like, well, that's not a realistic portrayal of a human being. They wouldn't do that. And yet they do.
Yeah.
Christ. Do you work as well? I mean, because you mentioned Rochdale, of course, and there's the grooming stuff going on at the extreme end of certain facets of Islam. Is that something that you would look into, Maggie Oliver's kind of terrain?
In essence, what Maggie's dealing with is child sexual exploitation. And is covered under, you know, what is now called the Modern Slavery Act in that whole process. So it is the recruitment, often by means of deception, for the purposes of exploitation, for the purposes of making money. And look, it's not just a problem in Islam. You know, if you look at the hard numbers, it's a problem across the whole of society in the UK. So it isn't. I know there's been a lot of media focus on the Asian Pakistani community in Rochdale and everything else. But we've had there were cases in Bristol, cases in Blackpool, cases in Telford, cases in London, cases in Glasgow. It's everywhere.
It's because Maggie said something that contradicts that, because I heard you say that on Sean Atwood's channel as well, and she was saying that it is very high, the British Pakistani, the percentage of those who are sort of taking these girls. So I suppose it depends on the sort of stats you're getting.
Yeah, look, I did a report looking at what was the scale and the nature of modern slavery across the whole of the UK back in 2011 to 2013, which became the catalyst for the Modern Slavery Act. And we looked at the level and the prevalence of child sexual exploitation. And it was the length and breadth of the UK. Every police force recognised that there was a problem with it and was struggling to deal with it. And it wasn't exclusive to any particular part of society or any particular nationality. And the facts, when you look at both the prosecutions and what we know about it, that holds true. There are certain towns where you would have a higher percentage of certain nationalities that I think then when you look at, when you slice and dice, you can make statistics, damn statistics and lies, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
You can make it work that way. Yes, it's a problem. And I think it's recognized that it's a problem within certain parts of the Pakistani community, but it's a problem equally in white British communities. Mm-hmm. You go to the States, you could say exactly the same in that whole process.
I think it's important that you say that. And also, of course, not all Muslims. I've often had a problem with any kind of extreme, when it gets to the extreme, religions, cults, that's when a lot of this stuff goes on. I've done a lot of work interviewing people, in Jehovah's Witness communities, Mormons, Hasidic Judaism, and extreme Islam. It does feel like, and again, it's not even necessarily a wider Islam problem. It seems to be very much concentrated on Pakistani Muslim, British Pakistani Muslims in the UK. I don't know what reason that might be or what's going on. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I've read academic papers on it. I've listened to, I know what Maggie Oliver says on it. From the research that we did when we were looking into slavery across that. Yeah, there are some cultural issues at play. In terms of, what happens or the cultural perceptions in one country have remained, in the diaspora community around that. But look, let's not kid ourselves that it's a problem unique to the UK. It's a problem everywhere in the globe.
Yeah.
It's a problem across all sections of society. We started with Jeffrey Epstein and the hoi polloi, and now we're in Rochdale. I'm just telling you, every other point between it, back to my 40 or 60, none of us have got clean hands in any of this.
That's true.
We might say, okay, I'm not a perpetrator, I'm not a trafficker, but the way that I consume, the world that I live in is, has this element of 50 million slaves.
And we have to reconcile with that. And it's not an easy thing to think about.
No.
And we have to start, these are the difficult conversations we need to have.
Yeah.
Tell me about, was it Robert? Somebody, I mean, it's not the real name. There's a story about somebody called a 6'6" man.
So let me end the story of how I got into this.
No,
that's fine, because that will lead us to Robert. So these two stories hit, and then I read this article that talked about trafficking from Eastern Europe to the US, where they used to use the regional airports in order to avoid the detection, because there was some focus, in the major hub airports, both in the UK, Europe, and in the US. One of the airports' name was Bristol, which is where I live. I went, oh, hang on. And in my brain, I went, oh, Ukraine story number one, trafficking, Ukraine story number two, trafficking. Now there's this article, trafficking, but it's Bristol. And because we were doing a lot around working with the poor and the marginalized and all of that, I did what I thought was normal. So I wrote to every single councillor, every single MP and the chief constable and said, I've become aware of this issue. I'm joining the dots in my head. What's going on? A whole list of questions around that.
Like, great.
And out of the blue, I then got a call from a very senior police officer who invited himself to coffee. And it was one of those calls that you can't refuse the coffee invite, even though they were coming. And he came. His name was Steve. And we literally had he walked in and he said, okay, I'm going to tell you everything. And we had a 4-hour conversation, and it was like he lifted a lid off the city and then a lid off the UK. And what he was frustrated with is he said, look, we're aware, and this is 2007, I think, from memory. At that time, he said, look, we're aware of 65 to 75 illegal brothels, residential brothels in the city of Bristol.
Christ.
We know that the women in there are victims. All we can do back then was we can kick a door in, we arrest the women because that's the only way we can take them out. So I'm conflicted because I'm arresting a victim. We stick them in a B&B and a hotel overnight to keep them safe. They disappear. We know they've gone straight back to their trafficker. They'll be moved to a different part of the country. Case goes cold. So I'm frustrated as a copper because I can't get after the bad guys. I'm conflicted as a human being because I've arrested a victim and I now know they're back in exploitation. And at the end of that, he said, look, you've written this letter that has raised whole loads of questions. And if you wanted to get like the powers that be talking about it and focused on it, you've achieved it. Retire happy. Okay. He said, but look, any idiot can write a letter. I thought, that's a bit rude.
Yeah.
He said, but what are you actually going to do about it? And I don't, look, I've always had a bent towards social justice. And like without thinking about it, I said, what do you need? You know, sometimes like you see the words tumbling out of your mouth and you're thinking, hang on, did I just say that? Yeah. And he almost without thinking, he said, look, I need safe housing. I need to be able to put these victims somewhere safe where they've been cared for. Because I know if we care for victims really well, they're more likely to engage with us. They're more likely to then help us identify who the victims are. I'm then a happy copper and I can go and arrest the bad guys
right. In
that whole process. And again, like the words tumble out of my mouth. I said, okay, I'll do that. On one condition, you're my first trustee. And that literally was the genesis of Unseen.
That's a great story.
This woman that had been working the social orphan problem, Kate, she was a teacher and she came a short time after that. And she said, I'm done with teaching. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. I'm around for the next 3 or 4 months as I work out what I want to do with my life. If you've got anything interesting I could do, I said, do you fancy opening a safe house? I haven't got a clue. But, I've just agreed to do this. And she said, yes. And that literally was sort of words tumbled out of my mouth in response to understanding more about the issue and then saying, okay, we'll do that. I mean, we had no money. We didn't have a clue what to do. But the great thing was because Steve was connected and senior enough in the police force, I got into what was then SOCA, which is now the Serious Organized Crime Agency. It's now the National Crime Agency. And I got a bit more understanding of what was going on. Got me into the Home Office, so and reading vociferously, trying to understand what was going on, becoming more appalled at the scale of it. And what we said right from the get-go was, look, we're not just going to be a charity that is just going to do lots of safe housing, because that is an acceptance that shit happens, and we're just going to be picking up the pieces. We said, we'll do that, because that's the immediate need in front of it, but we are really interested in, like, how do you turn the tap off? Like, how do you stop slavery happening in the first place? I passionately believe we don't need to live in a world with slavery. There is no reason for it. It doesn't make economic sense, doesn't make any social sense. And if you meet victims and spend any time with victims, the horrendous outcomes of it. And so we've from get-go said we would do that. And we opened the safe house about 18 months after starting the charity in that whole process. In the meantime, we'd got sort of into sort of Home Office meetings and everything else. And it became abundantly clear to me that the response was just completely inadequate in the UK. So I started lobbying a friend of mine that worked for a think tank here in London, saying, it was called the Centre for Social Justice. I said, if you're anything to do with social justice, this is the biggest issue, you need to look at it. And I was a right pain in the ass to them for about 2 years saying, you've got to look at it, you've got to look at it, you've got to look at it.
I just say that I think a lot of my viewers might cringe at the name social justice because it's obviously a buzzword at the moment meaning other things. But I think this is definitely one kind of social justice that I think everybody except for the traffickers can get behind.
Yeah. Historically, the way that sort of slavery has been understood in terms of like criminal justice response is it's on a parallel with murder. Mm-hmm. The Modern Slavery Act that's now on the UK legislation says that the maximum tariff for committing this crime is life.
Okay.
So it's
good.
Serious. in that respect. So I lobbied this think tank, and in the end, they said, look, we found the funding. Would you head it up? And so for 2 years, we interviewed 200 organizations and individuals, the length and breadth of this country, talked with some people overseas as well, and then produced a report in March 13 called It Happens Here. And it basically said, the scale of modern slavery in this country is much, much bigger than anybody thought. The response is completely inadequate. Mm. And we said, we need to see primary legislation, because police were saying to us, we don't know how to prosecute these things. You know, we've got bits here, there, and everywhere. It's really, really difficult. We said we need an independent anti-slavery commissioner. We need businesses to tell us what they're doing about their supply chains, transparency in supply chains. We need much better protection for victims and support for victims. We need to recognize that children are caught up in this as well, and there needs to be a real focus on that. There needs to be a national helpline. And we had 80 recommendations. We released the report in March. We got really lucky. We grabbed the 24-hour news cycle. I spent a day, you know, on the day the report was released, you know, from 5 a.m. till about 11 p.m. at night, doing the whole media round and all of that. That report was put into David Cameron's hands. Theresa May got hold of it. And 8 weeks later, I was in the cabinet office with the full cabinet. And the outcome of that meeting was Theresa May said, based on this report, we're going to bring forth the Modern Slavery Act. And then I lost 2 years of my life in Westminster helping shape the Modern Slavery Act.
That's fascinating. Well, you know, good on you and good on them for prioritizing it, as our politicians should be doing.
Yeah. It's a shame they're now filleting it.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's no good. Different leaders, though.
Different leaders, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was just conscious of time, because I would ask you all about that, but I want to
but
know
Robert.
About, I want to know Robert, yeah.
So Robert was one of the first people I met who, again, like completely messed with my head and my understanding of what it was. So we were invited to be part of what was called a reception center. So the police were going to raid this farm where they knew people were in forced labor situations. And then they'd be brought to this reception center, looked after by NGOs, so that we could reassure the victims they weren't in trouble, they weren't, you know, going to get prosecuted, everything was taken care of. There was a prior operation to that, so they arrested all the perpetrators in advance, executed the early morning raid, brought all the workers back, and then I spent all day in this very cold church hall, along with others, just trying to reassure these people that they were okay. And they wouldn't talk at all in that whole process until one of them came forward and said, yeah, we are being exploited. We're not paid, you know, double shifted, tired accommodation, we're in debt, bondage. We're moved from our accommodation to the farm. And here's the thing, the farmer was oblivious. He was paying national minimum wage, backs, doing all his returns correctly. What he didn't see was the traffickers had complete control of their bank accounts, all of the bank cards.
Oh my.
Would take all the money out and then use those bank accounts for money laundering activities.
Gosh.
As well. So finally, and actually it was this tiny woman who had the courage to say it. And then they all said, yeah, it's all true and everything else. And then what we said to them was, look, you've got your old jobs back. You're going to be get compensation for the money that you should have got. And you've also got all new accommodation have been sorted for them, everything else. So we then helped them all go there. And what one of the guys we were looking after was Robert. Robert was 6'6", and he was built like a rugby player. I used to play rugby. He would have kicked the crap out of me.
Right. Taller pitch. Than me. Six,
yeah, taller six. Than you.
Yeah.
And what the thing that messed with my head was, we took him to the house, and he was in the house with three or four other people that he was with. And he looked me in the eye and said, am I safe? I said, no, you're safe. He said, how do I know I'm safe? You know, they said, all of your exploiters were arrested early this morning before you were taken from the farm. They're in jail. They're not going to, you know, well, they're in custody. They're not going to get out. It's a, you know, open and shut case. So they'll go to, you know, to prison while they're on remand in that whole process. Am I safe? And what struck me was, here's someone 6'6", who was broken and worried about his safety. I mean, I'm 6'2", and I don't worry about my, you know, very rarely ever worry about my personal safety. And yet, this is what slavery does to people. It's not just the dehumanization of them. It is the fact that they don't feel safe, they feel threatened. And it is quite possible that threats had been made against his family at home as well in that whole process. You know, I've met victims that say, you know, the way that they controlled me was they'd take out their mobile phone and go, "Is that your mother? Look at the date. You say anything, you step out of line, they get it." Whether that's true or not is immaterial. They believe it.
Yeah, of course.
Or I've met victims that have been brutally beaten or witnessed others brutally beaten as a means to control them psychologically so they can't go forward.
I feel emotion in your voice when you speak about Robert. Is it, this is a tremendous weight for you.
To me, it was a wake-up call in terms of it can impact anybody. Well, Robert ended up in that situation. All he was trying to do was earn an income to support himself and his family. He had come to this country, the pre-Brexit days, he'd come to this country to, you know, pull vegetables out of the ground that end up in the supermarket that you and I buy. That's how close we are to this issue. And if it can happen to him, it could happen to anybody else. And to have to reassure a fully grown, strapping, 6'6" person to assure them that they're safe is an indictment on the world that we live in.
Well, speaking of that, there's been some news recently just about forced surrogacy. That's been in the press at the moment. What can you tell me about that? Because that's pretty horrific, just as a thought, very dystopian.
It is. And we're responsible for that being in the press. So, as I said, we run the UK's Modern Slavery Helpline, launched our figures and our analysis of 2023. And for the first time, we had 4 cases reported to the helpline of what's called forced surrogacy. So someone forced against their will to carry a child. So, yeah. And you may say, oh, it's only four cases. But what we've learned over the years is that what happens is these anomalies pop up. And we've learned that, okay, we need to just say, we've seen this. We're not hyping it or anything else. We're saying, there are 4 cases, so it's happening. What we often find is because we then say that, others then come forward and go, okay, I'm going to call the helpline because that's my situation, or I'm aware of that situation. Now, my hope and my prayer is we don't get any more calls about it, and it is an aberration. But if it is something, then there's a number of things. One, it just shows that there is nothing that exploiters will not do in order to make money, in order to exploit people. But then it becomes an issue of, okay, we need to make sure that the NHS are aware of this. Because are these people going through the NHS services, you know, midwifery and everything else? What are the telltale, you know, can we glean anything from the information that we've got? And remember, we only get the information that we get. And what people are prepared to tell us, but are there any patterns, any analysis, anything that we can just share so that people go, oh, hang on, if there's that, I just need to be a bit more curious, ask another question. Mm-hmm. In that whole process,
it's a shock to hear, but it's not a surprise that it happens. I think because you've already established people will do anything for money. They'll completely dehumanize people, treat them just as objects. We know. I mean, I know from investigating Scientology that you're taught to just see your children as little workers who will help, and that's a lot of cultures that do that. China, the one child policy, of course, they drowned daughters because the boy was more useful to them. And we know about the celebrity surrogacy stuff going on. I mean, yeah. what do they pay to have a child in their life? There must be a huge number on that for a black market.
Well, we know that exists. I think what we're seeing is people saying, "I'm being forced to do this against my will." But it's a bit like organ trafficking. Mm-hmm. You know, this year there were 3 new trends that we said, you know, Last year it was all about the care sector. That is still romping away. But this year it was forced surrogacy, organ harvesting.
What a world we live in.
Yeah. And there's a brilliant film by a Canadian filmmaker who goes to this village in Indonesia, and every single male in the village has a scar here.
Oh my gosh, on the side of their chair for those listening on audio.
And what they were told was, we'll give you don't need both kidneys. True. My mother only has one kidney.
Right.
So we'll give you $5,000 for your kidney. You live in a village in Indonesia. That's okay. They're then flown to India, South Africa, whatever, because for a kidney to be used, you've got to take it out in medical conditions. Go through the whole operation. It's all done and everything else. They come to, here's the bill for the operation.
Oh, shut up. No way.
$5,000. And then they're flown back.
Oh, those poor people.
And then they don't have access to the drugs that you do need to take if you've only got one kidney in that whole process.
Oh.
Doesn't it end there, though? And you and I have seen it in the press. You know, these stories of people that go overseas to avoid the wait for a transplant. You can go and buy your kidney, go to South Africa, India, whatever. Anything. Don't ask where that kidney came from.
The thing is, if you need a kidney, you need a kidney. You know? You're going to get it anyway.
So
if I needed a kidney and I'm told that was taken from somebody it shouldn't have been taken from.
Yeah.
I think, I don't want to die.
No. But how is society going to deal? Now that I've thrown into the mix that awkward information.
Yeah.
Does that justify I need a kidney. That person's, they didn't even get $5,000 for their kidney in that whole process.
It's horrible.
Or is the question that we need to ask is, we have a problem with organ donation. So you have to opt in this country, don't you?
Yes.
To have your organs out. Well, why not just flip it? You're in unless you opt out.
I would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
That would significantly reduce the waiting lists.
And then we wouldn't be going for these cheap.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the same thing over and over again. Cheap goods, cheap services, cheap labor.
Because some people,
cheap organs.
Religious beliefs and things. You know, and also it is something that we don't like to think about, dying and people taking organs out of us. It's a horrible thought. And there's something about taking and actually checking yes on a thing, which is like, oh, I don't want to think about that.
Yeah.
Whereas if it was just already the way and you have to check no, so many people would just, okay, well, I'm not thinking about it. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, it's the whole psychology of how, what is the question that you ask people in that whole process? But we live in this interconnected world. I hope people have picked that up. 40, 60 slaves, organ, et cetera. What's my personal responsibility? Mm. What are the decisions that I make? What are the things that I do that have an impact on my fellow human being?
Oh, my God. Oh, these are profound questions. And they're things that I know I'm not going to be able to sleep thinking about.
Put them in the comments underneath. Let's have answers in the comment section underneath.
Which one should we go with? Would you rather have to opt out of the organ situation? I'm always intrigued. You know, there are so many people who watch, and there's always something, there's an angle you haven't thought of. So somebody will be upset with us and say, no, you know, but by all means, tell us why that might not be a good idea. I've got another question for you, but before, just tell me, where do you want people to go after watching this?
So you can check out what we do at our website, unseenuk.org. Mm-hmm. So please do that. Follow us on all the social media channels. I'm sure we can stick it in the notes underneath around that. Support us as a charity. I get to say that as a charity, don't I? Look, it's an unfair fight. I'm fighting a $500 billion profitable industry. Last year, globally, we spent $380 million trying to tackle modern slavery. It's a massive unfair fight. But we've achieved some great things. You know, not just us and other NGOs have done that in the fight against modern slavery. You know, I remember when, going back to like the Modern Slavery Act, I remember sitting in the Home Office and they said, you'll never get primary legislation. You definitely won't get transparency in supply chains because we're in the middle of a business red tape challenge. An independent anti-slavery commission, you're not going to get one of those. Helpline, not one of those. Better support for victims, no, you're not going to get that. 12 months later, I'm standing in front of a minister in a conference and I went, I'm 5 for 5. What's next?
What's next? You like a challenge and you're doing you're doing amazing work. You're saving lives. Tell me, who is a heretic you admire?
So my heretic is a person called Bishop Oscar Romero, who was a El Salvadorian bishop who was killed.
Ah.
And I studied him when I was at university, and I've continued to study him. And he made this statement, which, you know, sometimes people say something and it just slaps you across the face and it just doesn't let go. And he said this, and there's a military junta oppressing the people. He's speaking out against it. And he'd been on a journey. He was like a complete right wing, mustn't say anything to upset everything else. And then a friend of his was murdered, and he had to bury him. And he was murdered because he was speaking out on behalf of the poor. And a few years later, he says this. He says, when I feed the poor, the government love me. When I say, why are they poor? They call me a communist and they will kill me. And the government murdered him a few years later in his church.
Oh my God. What an amazing story. What a beautiful example of a heretic.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew Wallace. What a brilliant episode. What a brilliant person. I mean, it's extraordinary that we have people in the world who do things like this. So thank you so much to him. Please go and look at weareunseen.org to just, I just think it's mind-blowing, like what he does. There just really aren't enough of us doing things like that. So good on him. Please help him. weareunseen.org, and I'll see you next time.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.